You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 270, Exodus 11 and 12. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Pretty good. It's been a fun week. Productive.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I forgot to mention, but I watched the Ten Commandments over the weekend, so that was fun. So I feel like I'm ready for the Passover and the Red Sea,
Right. The pump is primed. Right. Yeah.
But it's still good.
No,
we actually
talked about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually did it, so it was good. It's as good as I remembered.
Yeah. I know there were my daughter and her husband, they watched Prince of Egypt like the evening before, Easter dinner and stuff like that. So, you know, we were sitting around talking about, I bet Trey's watching the Ten Commandments,
and you would be correct. You would be correct. Yep.
So, yeah, I'm a prophet now.
Hey, look at that. Yeah, it's hard to watch
how that works
with all the inaccuracies of it, just a lot of the Bible stuff, nobody gets it 100%. And if you take it with a grain of salt and just enjoy it, because I see online a lot of people being so negative and bashing other Christians for watching that show and stuff like that. It's like, I'm not taking it literally, it's not 100% accurate, but I can enjoy it for what it is.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, just keep it in context. Yep.
Yeah. It's okay. Keep it in context. That's exactly right.
We're better off bashing Christians watching things like Ancient Aliens and, wondering about that. So,
yeah.
Ten Commandments isn't quite at that level.
Yeah. Weren't you just asked to be back on that?
Yeah. The fifth time. You would think after five times or after four other times, they would know what the answer is going to be. But no,
Well, I think you should do it. I'm one of the ones that you need to go wherever you can go. Because
I don't trust them.
I hear you.
I just do not trust. Okay, just for the sake of our listening audience, this little rabbit trail. I get this email from the producer, the associate producer of Ancient Aliens. Again, this is the fifth time I've been asked to be on this show. So in the email request, we'd like to invite you, to be on Ancient Aliens, and we want to discuss your book, The Realm of the Unseen. It's like you can't even get the book title right.
Sequel.
I mean, what if you're doing any kind of research? I mean, it's just an Amazon search. I mean, in a microcosm, that just typifies the whole thing right there. Yeah. So,
what's funny is that's important to me too. Is like, I use my last name, Strickland. A lot of people spell it Strickland, mm-hmm. and they don't take the time to see it. Tells me how professional people are. And so I always use that as a test to see if people's paying attention, how professional they are and stuff like that. But regardless, I like the name of that book. You need to call your sequel, that. That's awesome. The Realm of the Sea.
Yeah, just sprinkle a little more cheese on it.
That's awesome. That's what the movie needs to be called. The Realm.
The Unseen of the Aliens. Unseen
of Middle Earth. It's perfect.
Oh, man.
I love it.
So, yeah, thanks for bringing that up.
Hey, I still think you should do it because worst case scenario, people hear your name and then they Google you, find out more information, and that's where you can
say the worst case scenario is like what happened to me with the History Channel, 10 years or whatever it was, back in 2003. So I guess that's 15 years ago, but I don't get cut out of the program. And, in other words, I'm one of the people that they did dirty back 15 years ago, where they splice sentences together and make them say things like, that they don't believe, like what they did to Hugh Ross and that show that I would have been in.
But can't you?
I mean, that's the worst case.
Put that in your contract, or can't you tell them don't do this?
No, you don't give them a contract. They give you a contract.
Well, I know, but you got to tell them, hey, some of my terms is this. I want green M&Ms only. I want, you hear about all those stories.
They will not. I've already had this conversation with them. They will not give, quote, the talent veto power over editorial.
They just won't do it. I
understand that, but it just seems like you would be able to say, hey, don't do this or this, and give them a chance. Maybe it's a new producer. Maybe it's somebody that's actually trying to be accurate. I don't know. You never know. Again, if I live in
maybe
the camp.
Maybe pigs are going to start flying, too.
Yeah, there's no such thing as bad press, in my opinion. I'm one of those guys. You know, I mean, I'd rather just have your name, you know, name out there anywhere marketing,
right.
and then
right.
let them find you. Then
right. it's my name is the point. That's
right.
The
Let's use
here.
Your name.
Right.
As long as it's your name, it's okay. But
it's just painful. Yeah, it's just painful.
Well, yeah. All right, Mike.
So anyway,
there you go. Well,
other than that, it was a good week. Other than that email.
Yeah. Yeah. Well. We got through the plague, except we got one more left.
That's a good segue from ancient aliens to the death of the firstborn right there. There's something in there.
There you go.
Makes that a natural segue, so we might as well. But yeah, we're going to hit Exodus 11 and 12 today. And since we're doing it that way, we're going to hit the final plague and the Passover. And we will return later, you know, in the course of going through Exodus. To Exodus 12. We'll return to the Passover for some other reasons. But again, just for the sake of accounting for our episodes here, Exodus 11 and 12 is going to be our focus today. And we'll hit the final plague and the Passover. So what I want to do is I'm going to just start off by reading the first seven verses. Let's make it the first 10 verses, because it's sort of a quick problem, but there is sort of a setting problem that some people would take as an apparent contradiction in these verses. So I want to get that out of the way before we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of the plague and the Passover. So in Exodus 11, again, I'm reading from the ESV, we read this. The Lord said to Moses, "Yet one plague more I will bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will drive you away completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people, that they ask every man of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor for silver and gold jewelry. The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. So Moses said, thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go out in the midst of Egypt, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on his throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle, there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been, nor ever will be again. But not a dog shall growl against any of the people of Israel, neither man or beast, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel." Let me see here. Do I want to read? Yeah, let's. I'll tack on the verses eight and nine here. "And all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, 'Get out, you and all the people who follow you.' And after that, I will go out." And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pharaoh will not listen to you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt." Now you say, well, what's the issue here? If you go back to verse 2, you know, where God is talking to Moses in verse 1, and God says to Moses, "Speak now in the hearing of the people." That creates the impression, especially when you get this little parenthetical thought in verse 3 about how the Lord gave the Israelites favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and Moses was great in the land of Egypt, and Pharaoh's servants, and all the people sort of looked at him, you know, and were impressed, so on and so forth. It makes it sound like Moses is now standing before like a crowd or something, and this is a big public announcement about what's going to happen. But that isn't the case. If you look at verses 8, 9, and 10, it's very clear that Moses is speaking to Pharaoh still. You know, when it says in verse 8, all these your servants, he's speaking to Pharaoh, shall come down to me and bow to me, get out. You know, get out of here. And then at the end of verse 8, and he, Moses, went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. So he's still in front of Pharaoh. And the prior chapter, chapter 10, sounded like Moses had already left. Remember, the chapter ended, "Then Pharaoh said to him, 'Get away from me, take care to never see my face again. For on the day you see my face, you shall die.' And Moses said, 'As you say, I will not see your face again.'" So it sounds like he leaves And it sounds like we have this interlude with Moses in front of the people. Again, he's speaking to the people, but then it turns around in verses 8, 9, and 10, and it's very transparent again that he's still with Pharaoh. The chapter 11 ends, Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. He did not let the people of Israel go out of his land. So it just seems like the author and or editor of the text here can't make up his mind as to where Moses is at. It's really not that big of an issue because it's all resolved if you take the first verb of chapter 11. Okay, chapter 11, verse 1. Instead of saying the Lord said to Moses, you could, again, say the Lord had said to Moses. That's a perfectly legitimate translation. And so this backgrounding information, or the first few verses are backgrounding. It's not like Moses is somewhere else and then he has to come back to Pharaoh after he's just left and all that sort of stuff. So I wanted to make a comment on that. Again, this is easily rectifiable just by, you know, going from a past tense to a past perfect, you know, sense. And the Hebrew form of the verb allows you to do that. It's perfectly legitimate grammatically. It's not a forced sort of translation. So again, you might run into this somewhere that, you know, oh, you know, look at how the text is a mess here and guy can't make up his mind where Moses is. Again, that's a fabricated problem. So I wanted to mention that before we move on. What we really want to focus on, again, is what happens with the death of the firstborn and, of course, you know, the Passover. And so we just read through the 10 verses of chapter 11, gives us the setting, and we get right into chapter 12, and we start off with the commentary, the explanation of the origin story, if you will, of Passover. And then we're going to hit the final plague and then a few more thoughts on Passover anyway. So I'm going to read Exodus 12, just so that we have this in our head, the first 17 verses. And then I'm going to skip to verses 43 through 51, because that also deals with the Passover as an institution. So beginning in verse 12, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be for you the beginning of months. It shall be the first month of the year for you. Tell all the congregation of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, every man shall take a lamb according to their father's houses, a lamb for a household. And if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his nearest neighbor shall take according to the number of persons. According to what each can eat, you shall make your account for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. And you shall keep it until the 14th day of this month, when the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill their lambs at twilight. Then they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and the lintel of the houses in which they eat. They shall eat the flesh that night, roasted on fire. With unleavened bread and bitter herbs they shall eat it. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled in water, but roasted, its head with its legs and its inner parts. And you shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning you shall burn. In this manner you shall eat it, with your belt fastened, your sandals on your feet, your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. This day shall be for you a memorial day, and you shall keep it as a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. As a statute forever, you shall keep it as a feast. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven out of your houses. For if anyone eats what is leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. On the first day you shall hold a holy assembly, and on the seventh day a holy assembly. No work shall be done on those days. But what everyone needs to eat, that alone may be prepared by you. And you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread, for on this very day I brought your host out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a statute forever. Now that's the first 17 verses. And when we get down to verse 43, it sort of picks up on that. We have the death of the firstborn as the interlude. And so in verse 43, we read, and the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, this is the statute of the Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it, but every slave that is bought for money may eat of it. after you have circumcised it. No foreigner or hired worker may eat of it, and it shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside the house, and you shall not break any of its bones. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. If a stranger shall sojourn with you and would keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised. Then he may come near and keep it. He shall be as a native of the land, but no uncircumcised person shall eat of it. There shall be one law for the native and for the stranger who sojourns among you. And all the people of Israel did as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron, and on that very day the Lord brought the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts, or with their hosts. You could translate that. So that's the bulk of Exodus chapter 12. And again, we'll pick up with the death of the firstborn in a moment. But I want to make a few observations about Passover as an institution. Because again, we will be returning to this when we hit Exodus 23, especially. So first point, as far as observations go, is you'll notice as we read that, there was in Exodus this connection or merging of the Passover feast, and it is called a feast, and at least in a handful of passages in the Old Testament, a chag is the word for feast or festival. There's a merger of that with this feast of unleavened bread, and I say merger because there are other parts of Scripture where these two things are separate, and so there's a whole issue here of how the Passover and its rules, its observance, how it relates to the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Why is it separate in some passages? Why is it together in others? And also in relation to the other feasts. But the big one here is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And when we get to Exodus 23, we're going to talk about that in a bit more detail. It's really odd as well to point out that Passover is not mentioned in the entire book of Exodus other than this chapter. The feasts of Exodus 23 are therefore regarded by scholars as pre-Passover, the stuff that was around Israel culturally prior to Passover. And I'm going to repeat that. Again, this is just to telegraph the kind of thing we're going to be talking about when we hit Exodus 23. This is the only chapter where Passover is talked about in Exodus. Whereas in Exodus 23, you get sort of the holy festival calendar of the nation. And it doesn't talk about Passover. It talks about these other feasts. And one of those other feasts is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which if you go back to Exodus 12, somehow gets aligned with Passover. So there's this big academic discussion that relates, as you can imagine. We've talked about this kind of thing many times on the podcast and specifically with Exodus. It gets into the issue of when was Exodus written, or what parts of Exodus, when were they written, to sort of order or reorder what's going on in the calendar, the festival calendar in ancient Israel. So again, I want to sort of set it up, because this is why, when scholars have these discussions, the impression that we get a lot of times is that you got a bunch of guys, sitting in a smoke-filled room, and they're like, oh, what can we say to people that will, the stuff they haven't heard in church that'll bother them a little bit, we'll get a kick out of that. Let's just sort of make something up to rattle their cages. Well, okay, that occasionally happens. I have to own that, because I've seen that, happen. But most of the time, it's just stuff like what I just described. There are just oddities or features of the biblical text that you kind of don't see unless you're intentionally like trying to be alert for these things. And so people have noticed, why isn't Passover lumped in with this other stuff later? Because we have it first here in Exodus 12. And when you get 20, why does the book do this stuff? Why does the writer do this? And that becomes part of this matrix, this whole discussion about the authorship and the editorial hands, the editorial intention behind the book of Exodus, or behind the Torah, more widely. So the issues aren't contrived. I mean, the text itself produces real questions. And the issue is, well, what kind of answers do you come up with that make any sense? Are you just throwing something out there and then arguing in a circle to prove your little hypothesis, or does what you're saying actually make some sense? Now, Carpenter, has a little bit of a comment here. And again, I don't want to get too far into these weeds, but when we talk in Exodus 23, when we get there, about the festival calendar and all that stuff, we'll get into calendar issues more. But you can already see in Exodus 12, in relation to Passover, just the second verse, this month shall be for you the beginning of months, like the beginning of the year. Well, Israel already had a calendar before this. They're like any other ancient, and you know, we know this from various passages, and we know it just by having our head screwed on correctly. Every culture is going to have a calendar, and it's going to be an agricultural calendar. There's going to be a time of the year when you plant. There's going to be a time of the year when you harvest, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Your year is arranged in an agricultural society by what you eat, what you harvest, what you eat, what you plant, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they're already doing things like observing the cycles of the moon and the sun and all that kind of stuff. So Israel already had a calendar, but the beginning of the calendar, which, you know, in ancient inscriptions, okay, let's just take the Gezer calendar. And if you're an academic listening to this, I know that the Gezer calendar might not be epigraphic Hebrew. I get that. It might be Phoenician. It's indeterminate. You know, so be it. But that's not the only sort of place where you get indications that Israel, ancient Israel, had an agricultural calendar. You get that in the biblical text as well. But the Gezer calendar is kind of a neat illustration because it's a calendar. It's arranged, you know, this way. So what about this changing of the calendar here? This is at the heart, these first few verses of Exodus 12 are at the heart of the whole topic or discussion. And some of you who are like into calendars and chronology, you know, you'll be aware of this already. That and even if you pay attention to modern Judaism, you'll discover this, that Israel had more than one calendar. And this passage is in part why. They already had an existing agricultural calendar with its month names. Now they get a different calendar because they're being reborn as a nation. And Passover is going to mark the birth, hence the new year, you know, of this particular calendar now. They never, you know, dispense with the old one. They just adopt the new one, and you have this interplay between these different calendars. Again, you're already going to be somewhat aware of that. But let me read what, you know, Carpenter's little summary here without getting too deeply into the woods here. Carpenter writes, in order to celebrate her birth with proper recognition, Yahweh changes Israel's calendar. The beginning of the year is the day they came forth from Egypt. This was a new time of creation. Again, that's kind of, you know, obvious as to why this would happen at this point. Let me continue with Carpenter here. The months shall now be remembered, beginning with the month of the Exodus, from a definite time in history, not from a distant primordial or mythical past. The name of the month used here, Abib, means fresh ears of grain and is equivalent to March or April. And Carpenter references Exodus 13:4 for that. Today in the month of Abib, you are going out, and 9:31. The flax and barley were struck down, for the barley was in the ear, the flax was in the bud, so on and so forth. The name was changed later to Nisan, and this actually happens in the biblical record. This is Nehemiah 2:1. The month of Nisan, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, so on and so forth. And again, if you read through Nehemiah, you'll find out that this month name, you know, Nisan, you know, corresponds to this Abib, you know, earlier in Israel's history. The name was changed later to Nisan when Israel borrowed that name from the Babylonian calendar during the exile. Of course, Nehemiah is writing after the exile, so this is something that's already in Israelite culture. It appears that Exodus 23:16b and Exodus 34:22b record a time in the fall for the end of the agricultural year, and so possibly the beginning of a new year. But the basis for the spring festival of Passover and these fall observances is entirely different in Exodus. The solution to the seeming fall, spring, new years, plural, has not been fully solved, but it is plausibly suggested that there were two new years in Israel, one in the fall and one in the spring. One in the spring being tied to the religious calendar, and one in the fall to the agricultural calendar. And he references Sarna's commentary there. Now, again, you just have this going on both in the Hebrew Bible and, you know, again, just in the history of Israel. And Exodus 12 is, you know, part of that whole set of circumstances. So I don't want to get, you know, too far into the weeds about, you know, Israel's calendar and whatnot, which calendar should be used, because I get these emails. I got one actually providentially, you know, two days ago, about which calendar should we be using, Mike? You know, which calendar is the sacred one? Is it the, you know, is it the calendar that the Qumran people used? Is it this calendar or that other calendar? Because we know like the Pharisees' calendar came from the Babylonians and it's pagan. Well, that's actually not true. I mean, Israel had a calendar already in place that wasn't the one used at Qumran and that wasn't even one of the two found in Scripture. It wasn't pagan. It was already in place. Now, the pagan idea comes from the adaptation of Babylonian names for the months of the calendar, but that was something that happened during the exile when the Israelite, the Jewish, as they're going to be referred to then, when the southern tribes are in Babylon for the exile, they are going to appropriate those month names for their own calendar. So that doesn't mean the calendar was pagan. It just means they changed month names. That's all they did. And the Hebrew Bible, again, is going to show evidence of this and incorporate these sorts of things. And by the way, again, without getting into the weeds, the Qumran calendar was not an astronomical calendar. These other ones are, you know, one of them at least is sort of rooted to astronomy. If you're going to lump in the seasons there, it's an agricultural calendar. That's going to coincide with certain months, you know, certain events like the solstices and whatnot. So it has astronomical elements. That's a solar elements there. You also have, you know, lunar elements in the Israelite calendar because of the cycles, you know, the moon, basically 30 days, which is a month, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, none of this is pagan. The news flash here is that people living everywhere, whether it's Israel or Egypt or Babylon or wherever, they're all looking at the same moon. They're all looking at the same sun. This is how you mark time in the ancient world. It's a calendar built out of observed phenomena, and everybody's looking at the same thing. So I think we need to sort of dispense with this, you know, one calendar's pagan, another one's not. That doesn't work real well. And the Qumran calendar basically ignored astronomy in favor of mathematical precision. And they had some very intentional things that they did to produce that calendar. But again, we're getting a little too far in the weeds here. I just wanted to bring this up because it becomes an issue for some. And I think we don't need to really get too distracted by what's happening here. Now, we will also in the future get into the differences between the rules for Passover here in Exodus 12 and the rules for Passover in Deuteronomy 16. They are not the same. In fact, there are points that they are 180 degrees opposed to each other. And there are circumstances as to why that is. I'm going to read a very brief paragraph here from Jeff Teague in his Deuteronomy commentary, the Jewish Publication Society commentary. He writes, "The difference between Exodus and Deuteronomy may be due to the fact that the original Pesach, you know, Passover in Exodus, was offered by individual households." Okay, well, we just read that. You observe Passover in your house. "For which even a single head of small cattle might have been too much to consume. Whereas Deuteronomy deals with a time when the sacrifice would be made at the central sanctuary and many households could share a larger animal." Specifically in Deuteronomy, you're told not to eat it in your house. It's just completely opposite. "Another possibility is that the Pesach offering originated at a time when the Israelites owned primarily sheep and goats, and that Deuteronomy reflects later conditions when large cattle had also become important in their economy." That's the end of Teague's quote. Now, all that's true, but Teague and others are going to, you know, go on from that, and they're going to say, hey, part of the picture here is because Deuteronomy is late. You know, Moses didn't write it. It wasn't written during the Mosaic period. It's written later when Israel was in the land and he had a temple, and that's the whole idea of the central sanctuary. So the rules change. Because if you remember, just as we read in Exodus 12, you have the observance of the Passover, then you got the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you've got solemn assemblies being observed. Well, you don't really like go into your house and have a solemn assembly there. The solemn assembly is a public event. Again, when we get into this material, it's like, well, where's the solemn assembly? Is it at the temple complex, or did they already go home and then they have one in their towns? I mean, how does this work? because the rules for Passover and its observance, the whole festival time, are different in these two chapters. So when we get to some of that later with the calendar stuff, we'll get into the weeds a little bit here. But right now, I think it's basically a distraction. So for our purposes, the rest of the time here, we want to get into the meaning of Passover. And this will be sort of the second observation that I make about Passover. And I have a couple more observations, this one and another one about Passover, and then the death of the firstborn. So that's where we'll focus the rest of the time here. Now, the meaning of the Passover. First thing I want to say here is the Passover is clearly, clearly substitutionary. It just is. In other words, the Passover lamb takes the place of people, takes the place of the people. Hence, its blood is a protection. Its life, the lamb's life, is taken in the place of people. All right? Exodus 12, 23 through 27. Okay? For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to strike you. You shall observe this rite as a statute for you and your sons forever. And when you come to the land that the Lord will give you as he has promised, you shall keep this service. And when your children say to you, "What do you mean by this service?" you shall say, "It is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover. For he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt when he struck the Egyptians, but spared our houses." Okay? It's very clearly substitutionary. And furthermore, the verb used in Exodus 12 to describe the ritual, the noun is Pesach, Passover. The verb is Pasach, okay? That is not the normative word for the act of like passing over something or passing by. That's a different verb. It's avar. Tige, again, says a little something about this as well that I think is worth citing. He, on his note on the Passover sacrifice, he writes, or you could translate this, protective sacrifice. So he actually likes the word protective instead of just Passover, because, again, the verb used here in this chapter is not the normal verb for passing over something or passing through something. It actually, the noun is going to be used for protection elsewhere. So back to Tige. He says, protective sacrifice. This sacrifice, called Pesach in Hebrew, reenacts the original Pesach sacrifice. Again, remember Tige's writing about Deuteronomy, so that's where he's getting this reenactment thing. This sacrifice, called Pesach in Hebrew, reenacts the original Pesach sacrifice that the Israelites performed on the eve of the Exodus, right before the last of the 10 plagues. The name is derived from the verb Pasach, which describes the manner in which God spared the firstborn in the houses of Israel after they smeared the blood of the sacrifice on their doorposts and lintels. In Exodus 12:13, 12:23, 12:27. The Vulgate, that's the Latin translation of the Bible. The Vulgate translates the verb as "the Lord passed over." And the Vulgate also translates the name of the sacrifice as Passover. Let me stop there. So this is where we get Passover language from the Latin Vulgate, which was, that's 5th century AD. This is why, and the early church, this is the time of the early church, after the church becomes legal in the Roman Empire, okay, this language in this passage just became institutionalized, Passover. And so Tige's saying, we kind of missed something by that language, which comes from the Vulgate. So back to Tige, he says, the Hebrew verb, however, does not mean pass over. Most of the ancient translations, older than the Vulgate, those translations, like Syriac, Septuagint, all that kind of stuff. Most of the ancient translations and commentaries render the verb as "the Lord spared," okay, or "the Lord had compassion," or "the Lord protected." And the name of the sacrifice is protective sacrifice, referring to the protection of Israel during the final plague. This rendering, says Tige, is supported by the way the verb is used in Isaiah 31, verse 5. Let me just read that to you. "Like birds hovering, so the Lord of hosts will protect Jerusalem. He will protect and deliver it." Again, the language of protection there, the second one, "he will protect and deliver it," the word there, we get this sense of clear protection. He will spare and rescue it. Okay, so you've got two verbs for protect, 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 and then you've got spare, and that's pasak, and then rescue is another verb, you know, for to deliver or rescue. Specifically, that one is malat, and the earlier two references are nagan. So you've got four verbs there. Three of them are very clearly about protection and rescuing, and then you've got pasak right in the middle of that. And Isaiah 31 translates it, spare. He will spare Jerusalem and rescue it. So I think Tige's observation is really important here. You know, we get this language from the Latin Vulgate, this Passover, and again, it's not like it's terrible, but it's a bit misleading because we sort of are led to miss the protective element. Then now the point of sparing, let me just throw something else in here. Let me throw in another resource. D.J. A. Klein's in his Dictionary of Classical Hebrew notes the sparing, again, the protection semantic of this particular Hebrew verb lemma. For those of you who are into Hebrew, DCH, Dictionary of Classical Hebrew, is a different set. It's a different scholarly lexicon than Halot, Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon of the Old Testament. DCH by Klein's is more recent. It's multi-volume. It may at some point replace Halot. Who knows? But the neat thing about it is it incorporates Dead Sea Scroll material for its semantic ranges, you know, as far as word meanings go. But Klein's, again, takes this trajectory as well. In his entry, he has Pesach or Pasach, the verb form specifically, as a homograph. Now, what that means is if you actually look up in a Greek or Hebrew lexicon, or Greek to English, Hebrew to English dictionary, there will be entries that have numbers like Pasach 1, Pasach 2, Pasach 3. All of the good lexicons do this because Hebrew is like English. It has homographs. It has words that are entirely distinct from each other that are spelled the same way. Okay, that's what a homograph is. And Pasach is one of these. It's a homograph. And one particular homograph is about protection. It's about sparing. It's about, again, this it has this substitutionary semantic to it. So Klein's actually lists the Exodus 12 occurrences of this verb in the entry under his Pasach number 3, to protect. So he doesn't view it as passing over anything because, like Tige, I mean, he knows that this is not your normative verb for passing over or passing by. It specifically has something to do with protecting, you know, sparing something. And in this case, the lamb becomes a substitutionary element. The lamb's life is taken in exchange for the people. Again, the people who are protected in this ritual. Now, why do I bring this up? Well, you probably already know. I mean, since Paul explicitly refers to Jesus explicitly as our Passover lamb, that's 1 Corinthians 5:7, pulls no punches here. Cleanse out the old leaven that you may be a new lump as you really are unleavened, for Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. So since Paul does this, he explicitly identifies Jesus with the Passover lamb, and that his death, obviously, the death of Jesus was sacrificial. Jesus, as the thing sacrificed, aligns well with the Passover lamb because the Passover lamb had to be unblemished. And of course, Jesus was unblemished. Okay, because of the typology of the Passover lamb, its nature as a substitution, it's really flawed to argue that the death of Jesus was not substitutionary. And this comes up all the time in these rabbit trail discussions on the atonement. Look, folks, it has to be substitutionary if it's going to be a typological fulfillment of the Passover lamb. And that point is explicitly made in the New Testament. Whether it offends you or not isn't the issue. It's in the text. Okay, now that isn't to say that the sacrifice of Jesus doesn't have other semantics that go with it, you know, other sorts of meanings, you know, there are other aspects to the atonement. It does. I mean, the atonement, the work of Christ, does have other aspects of meaning, you know, other ways you can talk about the atonement. So I'm not arguing that you know, that's not legitimate. It is. What's not legitimate is to argue that in the process of highlighting these other aspects of the atonement, it's hermeneutically flawed to conclude that the substitutionary element isn't there. It is, explicitly. And it has to be because of the typology with the Passover lamb. I mean, you know, John 19:36, you know, does sort of what Paul's doing in 1 Corinthians 5:7. John 19:36 says, "For these things took place that the scriptures might be fulfilled. Not one of his bones will be broken." Okay, well, where does that come from? Not one of his bones will be broken. Guess where it comes from? Exodus 12:46, Passover lamb, quote, "It shall be eaten in one house. You shall not take any of the flesh outside the house. You shall not break any of its bones." And Numbers 9:12, also speaking of the Passover, "They shall leave none of it until the morning, nor break any of its bones. According to all the statute for the Passover, they shall keep it." Okay, this, John does it. John connects the sacrifice of Jesus with the Passover lamb. So does Paul. Okay, it is very obviously substitutionary. So, yes, you know me by now, if you've listened to Q&As, I'm all in favor of the idea that the atonement should be looked at in a multitude of ways. But what typically happens is, while people love to look at it in alternate ways just so that they can deny substitution, okay, that is wrongheaded and it's hermeneutically flawed. You basically have to pretend that these passages aren't here, that the writers are not trying to strike the analogy when they explicitly do. So this, the connection is important. The connection between Jesus, you know, his body and his blood given sacrificially, in between, you know, there with the connections with the Last Supper. I mean, this is what you have going, you know, and obviously this is part, you know, this whole Last Supper thing. There's a big question, was the Last Supper a Passover meal? Now, there's a lot that can be said in favor of that. You know, it's not without controversy. It's a hotly debated item. So for those of you who are interested in the defense of the idea of the Passover or the Last Supper being a Passover meal, I've uploaded to the protected folder an article by Robin Rutledge. It's called Passover and the Last Supper. It's from Tyndale Bulletin, volume 53, number 2, 2002, pages 203 to 221. You can read it there. But I just want to read the abstract and a little bit of a section to you, because I do think that the Last Supper, it either was a Passover meal or was intentionally connected with the Passover. And that would make sense because of what John says about the death of Jesus, you know, the person, you know, not bone, not broken, and what Paul says more explicitly, you know, Jesus is our Passover lamb. So from Rutledge's article, here's the abstract. "The Synoptic Gospels present the Last Supper as a Passover meal. Whether this coincided with the actual Passover or, as some suggest, was held a day early, it was viewed by the participants as a Passover meal. And the words and actions of Jesus, including the institution of the Lord's Supper, would have been understood within that context. In order to better appreciate the significance of what happened at the Last Supper, this article looks at the form that the Passover celebration is likely to have had taken at the time of Jesus." Okay? "And notes links with the meal Jesus shared with his disciples." Now, that's the end of the abstract, but look. The rules for the Passover changed from Exodus to Deuteronomy, and they evolved further in Judaism. So if you're going to try to disconnect the Passover and the Lord's Supper based on Exodus and Deuteronomy, it's not quite a great strategy. What you really need to do is you need to look at how the Passover was observed in the first century. And this is what Rutledge is going to do in I don't know if it's a man or a woman here writing, you know, cuz Robin can be neutral. But that's what's going to happen in this article. So if you're interested in this, I invite you to read it. And the one section 2, I'll just read from this as well. "Was the Last Supper a Passover meal?" Just this will give you a flavor to the issues that the article covers. He or she writes, "This is a thorny question. You know, was the Last Supper a Passover meal? That has been the subject of many studies. The Synoptic Gospels indicate that the meal that Jesus shared with his disciples on the night before his arrest was a Passover meal. It is suggested that the fourth Gospel, wanting to emphasize the identification of Jesus with the Passover sacrifice, places the crucifixion a day earlier than the other Gospels, at the time the Passover lambs were being sacrificed in the temple. One approach to this difficulty is to accept that the accounts cannot be reconciled and to choose between them. The traditional view is that the Synoptic Gospels paint the more accurate picture historically, whilst the fourth gospel focuses on theological symbolism and has adapted the chronology in order to place the death of Jesus at the time of the temple sacrifices. More recent scholarly opinion has tended to favor John's chronology and views references to the Passover in the Synoptics as later additions by the early church, which had come to interpret the Lord's Supper as a Christian Passover. Attempts to harmonize the gospel accounts include suggestions that the Last Supper may have been some other kind of fellowship meal, maybe eaten in anticipation of the Passover, or that Jesus and his disciples celebrated the Passover according to a variant calendar, which is interesting in and of itself. If so, they may have eaten the meal early, though probably without a lamb. This seems unlikely in the light of Jesus' request for a place to eat the Passover, though. Few who support John's chronology would doubt that the similar expression in John 18:28 refers to a meal which included the Passover lamb. So why would the same not apply to the Synoptics? Of course, it could be argued that if the expression refers to the Passover meal in the Synoptics, it is reasonable to suppose that it also refers to the Passover meal in John. It is possible, though, that John, in the interest of theological symbolism, used the term Pascha, that's the Greek equivalent of Pesach, more loosely to refer to one of the other sacrifices offered during the Passover week. The lack of clear evidence means that we cannot be sure about the chronology. In my view, this is the writer, the author, Rutledge, in my view, it is more likely that the Last Supper was a true Passover meal, and the following outline will be based on that assumption. However, even if the Last Supper was eaten the day before Passover, the language of the Synoptic Gospels indicates that Jesus and his disciples celebrated it as a Passover meal. The only difference, then, would have been the absence of the lamb, and since this does not figure in the symbolism of the meal, the substance of what follows still stands. Of course, that's the end of the Routledge material. Of course, it is interesting, you know, in the absence of the lamb, we have Jesus present, and it's a foreshadowing of his death as the Passover, as Paul would say, our Passover lamb. So it's an interesting article for those of you who are really into this kind of, you know, synoptic stuff and, you know, the chronology stuff. That probably whets your appetite, but if you subscribe to the newsletter, you can get the article through the archive. It's at the bottom of every issue of the newsletter. A link, you know, to the protected folder where you can, you know, get some of this material. But let's just put it this way: going with Routledge's last paragraph there, whether it was the Passover meal or a meal associated with the Passover celebration in some way in the first century, you know, who cares? The issue is that the association is there in the Synoptic Gospels and John. They associate the death of Jesus with the Passover celebration. And that makes complete sense in light of what John says in John 19:36 about not breaking the bones. And it makes complete sense that Paul looked at it that way very explicitly in 1 Corinthians 5. And for us, we do the scripture harm if we deny that the death of Jesus, at least one role that it has, one meaning that it has, is substitutionary atonement. It very plainly is. It cannot align with the typology of the purpose of Passover, the Passover lamb, and not have that point. So again, I thought that was important and worth covering. Again, I'm a big tent guy when it comes to atonement discussion. I think the atonement can be looked at from a variety of aspects that are legitimate, but it is not legitimate to use that discussion to exclude and eliminate substitution. So there you have it. Third observation, Passover's connection to the last plague, the death of the firstborn. And I'm going to read Exodus 12, 12, and 13 again. So, you know, we talked about Passover. Let's get into the final plague here. And we'll address this like we've addressed the other plagues at some point here in a moment. But Exodus 12, 12 to 13 says this, "For I will pass through the land of Egypt that night, and I will strike all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And on all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will Pasak, I will pass over you, or more accurately, I will protect you. I will spare you. And no plague shall befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Now that it goes on, the 10th and final plague is described in detail in a few verses, Exodus 12, 29 through 32. So let's just read those. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive, who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the livestock. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where someone was not dead. Then he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Up, go out from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go, serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also." He wants them to intercede because he's done now. He's giving up. Now, this last plague, like the other ones, again, fits very nicely into the perspective of decreation. Again, Yahweh's mastery and control over creation order, as opposed to the fecklessness of Pharaoh and his magicians, his Khartoumim, you know, and his the gods of Egypt. It fits into, again, decreation, the overturning of Ma'at, the cosmic creation order. So it overturns that, you know, there's a decreation element, you know, demolishes the sense, the belief, the hope that Pharaoh and Egypt's gods can control the world order, the cosmic balance. It attacks that again, and by virtue of that, it is a polemic against Egyptian religion, Egyptian theology, what they believe about Pharaoh as a god and their gods. So the application in this instance is pretty simple, actually. The final plague was transparently directed against pharaonic succession. Okay, his firstborn dies. Now, the gods had set up Ma'at, and it was supposed to be transferred from one incarnation of Horus, i.e. the pharaoh, to the next, an unending, unbroken stream. If you recall from earlier episodes, when there was succession, when a pharaoh was dying or dead, it was a very serious thing. The succession had to be orderly and according to plan, according to Ma'at, according to the will of the Egyptian gods, so that the balance of creation, the heavens and the earth, you know, all of that would be maintained and things would go on as usual. You would prevent the eruption of chaos in the land. Well, that's pretty much trashed in the final plague because the God of Israel steps in and says, "We'll show you who has power over the cosmic balance, the control of heaven and earth here, the life cycles. We'll show you who has control over order and chaos right here." He takes away the succession. You know, the firstborn dies. This would be the son who is supposed to inherit the throne. The gods had set this up. They instituted Pharaoh as the incarnation of Horus, the son of Ra, to maintain divinely ordered Ma'at. The plan was supposed to be unending, transitioning from one pharaoh to the next through his firstborn son. So this amounts to a supernatural assault on Pharaoh's firstborn and a supernatural assault on the whole concept of Ma'at, Pharaoh as the one who maintains order, who acquiesces to the gods, who through ritual keeps his commitment to the gods and they will keep their commitment to Ma'at as well. This symbiotic, thing that just is supposed to go on and on. You know, no bumps in the road. Well, this is a huge bump in the road. It upends the whole idea. All of this, cosmic order, cosmic balance, is not in the control of Pharaoh and his magicians and their gods. This power is located really firmly in the hand of something else, someone else, and that is the God of the Hebrews. And basically, the Egyptians are at his mercy. You know, and Pharaoh wants closure. You know, he wants Moses and Aaron to bless him as he lets the people go. Because he knows he has no control over this situation. He's done. You know, he's a broken man. He's a broken deity. and so are the rest of his gods, because they can't intervene either. There's no ambiguity left in this picture. So that's what he wants to know. Once I let these people go, life, things will return to normal, that the God of the Hebrews has been appeased, you know, and you know, we're done with all this. So it's again, another assault on Egyptian religion. Now, before we leave this episode, before we wrap it up, I want to say a little bit about the destroying agent used by God in the last plague. And when you consider the terminology of the destruction of the firstborn in the wider, you know, Old Testament backdrop, believe it or not, the language loops in the angel of Yahweh, loops the angel of Yahweh into the scene, and in so doing creates yet another identification of the angel as Yahweh. Specifically, the verb, you know, used in these descriptions is shachat, to destroy, and the noun is mashkit. They share the same Hebrew root, the sh, the ch, and the t. This verb and this noun, again, there's a commonality there. And this terminology does get used of the angel of Yahweh. So I'm going to read a little bit from my angel's book. Again, for those who haven't read it, I mean, this will just give you a sampling, but it's relevant here. So it's not just a commercial. But from my angel's book specifically, this is pages 65 up to the top, page 68. I wrote this: the characterization of the angel of Yahweh as a destroyer, mashkit, in 1 Chronicles 21:16. Remember, this is the judgment on David with the census and all that. The angel of Yahweh is called a mashkit there. That characterization has ramifications for identifying another mysterious angel figure in the Old Testament. So I'm going to read 1 Chronicles 21:15 and 16 just to give the flavor here. God sent the angel to Jerusalem to destroy shachat, to destroy it. But as he was about to destroy it, shachat, there's the verb again, the Lord saw and he relented from the calamity. And he said to the angel who was working destruction, mashkit, it is enough. Now stay your hand. And the angel of the Lord was standing by the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite, and David lifted his eyes and saw the angel of the Lord standing between heaven and earth, and in his hand a drawn sword stretched out over Jerusalem. Again, the angel with the drawn sword in his hand, it occurs three times in the entire Hebrew Bible. Here, Joshua 5, okay, the captain of the Lord's host, the commander of the hosts of the Lord. And then in Numbers 22, the Balaam incident, where it's the angel of the Lord, you know, explicitly. So we know who this figure is. You know, if you've not read Unseen Realm, you're just going to have to catch up that way. This is God as man in the Old Testament. It's very significant language. It's not the only way that idea is expressed. You have the word, you have the name. Okay, you've got all this terminology going on in the Old Testament, but this is an important one. So not surprisingly, I wrote in the angel's book, the parallel passage in 2 Samuel, parallel to this punishment of David, uses the same terminology and forms. Let's read that, 2 Samuel 24:16 and 17. When the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, shachat, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who was working destruction, said to the mashkit among the people, it is enough, now stay your hand. And the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Arona the Jebusite. Then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking the people. Now it's clear from both passages that the angel of Yahweh is in view and that he brings mashkit, destruction. Interestingly, this is the identical term used to describe the angel of death in the account of the death of the firstborn on the eve of the first Passover. I'll read the passage again. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over, I will protect or spare you, and no plague will befall you to destroy you, mashkit, to mashkit you. When I strike the land of Egypt, then Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, go and select the lambs for yourselves according to your clans and kill the Passover lamb. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer, the mashkit, to enter your houses to strike you. It's Exodus 12, 13, 21, and 23. The mashkit, who was the angel of Yahweh in 1 Chronicles 21 and 2 Samuel 24, is here distinguished from Yahweh, and that's familiar, again, for those who have read Unseen Realm. So the angel here is distinguished from Yahweh by the line, the Lord will pass over over the door and will not allow the mashkit to enter your houses to strike you. Yet elsewhere, we read that it was Yahweh who destroyed the firstborn. This is Psalm 105, 26, and 36. He sent Moses, his servant, and Aaron, whom he had chosen. He, the Lord, in Psalm 105, Yahweh, struck down all the firstborn in their land, and the first fruits of all their strength. Psalm 135, 5 and 8. For I know that the Lord is great, and that our Lord is above all gods. It was he who struck down the firstborn of Egypt, both of man and beast. Lastly, Psalm 136, 3 and 10. Give thanks to the Lord of lords, for his steadfast love endures forever. To him who struck down the firstborn of Egypt, for his steadfast love endures forever. Now remember, the destroying angel of Yahweh is actually the visible Yahweh. Given that background, these statements are not incompatible. However, Psalm 78, 48 to 51 seems to complicate matters. So let me read you that. He, Yahweh, in context, gave over their cattle to the hail and their flocks to the thunderbolts. This is describing the plagues. He let loose on them his burning anger, wrath, indignation, and distress. A company of destroying angels, Hebrew is Malakei Ra'im. He made a path for his anger. He did not spare them from death. He gave their lives over to the plague. He struck down every firstborn in Egypt. There it is again. He did this. Yahweh did this. And the first fruits of their strength in the tents of Ham. Now, the complication is only on the surface level. It's really derives from English. We do not have the mashkit or the shakat terminology here for destroying angels. It's different. It's Malakei Ra'im, which is literally not, well, you could translate it bad angels or and that doesn't mean like fallen angels. Ra'ah, or ra, as an adjective in Hebrew, means unfavorable, distasteful, unfortunate, something you don't like. Okay, something that is against you. It doesn't necessarily mean moral evil or fallenness or anything like that. So the complication is only surface level. Back to my book, the ESV's translation, destroying angels, is somewhat misleading with respect to the terminology we are attempting to trace. The Hebrew term translated destroying is not the word mashkit associated with the destroyer in the passages we saw earlier. We should also observe that Psalm 78:49 does not say destroying angels killed the firstborn. It doesn't actually say that anyway. That act is once again attributed to Yahweh himself, verse 51. Yahweh may have sent angels to enact the other plagues. Okay, that's perfectly possible from Psalm 78. But the death of the firstborn is attributed to him. These angels do not act in the role of the destroyer. Therefore, given the use of the term mashkit of that angel in other judgments handed down by Yahweh, a coherent way to reconcile all these passages would be to have Yahweh receiving the credit for the judgment on the firstborn by sending out his mashkit, his destroyer, the angel of Yahweh, who elsewhere is identified as being him, as being the visible Yahweh. This would be akin to God himself being present in the burning bush, yet also having the angel of Yahweh present there. These and other passages are the foundations of the later Jewish theology of two powers, the two Yahweh figures. And again, I don't get into the two Yahweh thing in the book Angels. I get into it a lot in Unseen Realm, obviously. But here you go again. Here you go again. And isn't it ironic? Think about it. Since the New Testament writers are going to align Jesus with the second visible Yahweh figure, one of which is this particular angel, you have the destroyer, the destroying angel, who in the Old Testament, you know, was again Yahweh in visible form, judging evil and evildoers, okay, carrying out these sorts of judgments. And yet that same, you know, when you get to the New Testament, we're dealing with incarnation, so it's a bit different. It ups the ante, as I like to say. But you have the second person of the Godhead in human form now by virtue of the birth process, the incarnation, okay? It's the same figure, just a different way of the figure being present. But now you have him laying down his life to protect, okay? To protect those who would trust in him. Now he is the substitution for, you know, what needs to happen here. He is the substitutionary element. So the irony is pretty rich here. And the theology is just really, you could think a long time about that. Again, just how this stuff sort of turns back on itself, and how the tapestry gets woven in the Old Testament and then reaches its culmination point in the New. You know, here we go again. It's just another example of you could not be exposed to the podcast, to this episode or any other episode or my books or anything like this. You'd still know the gospel story. You know, you could read 1 Corinthians 5:7 about Jesus being our Passover lamb. And, you know, okay, I kind of get that. You know, he's the sort of the different counterpart to this sacrifice. You could understand all that. But there's a whole backdrop to it that sort of amplifies what's going on in the mind of the writers and the theological epic, the theological story they're actually telling. You just miss a lot of detail when you're not reading the text in light of its own context. And the destroyer here, it's the you know, the denouement, you know, the climax here of Yahweh's war against the gods of Egypt. And who finishes the job? You know, it's the angel of Yahweh. Again, who is this second person of the Godhead come as man, the form of a man, you know? Again, there's just so many layers to this. So I actually think this is a good episode if you've not gotten into this content, if you're a new listener. If you like books with footnotes, read Unseen Realm. If you don't, read Supernatural first and then graduate to Unseen Realm. And you're going to get a lot of exposure to this kind of connectivity between the Testaments that penetrates far beyond the surface. And the surface is important. Again, the alignment of Jesus with the Passover lamb, that's important. But it's a whole lot deeper than that. It's a rabbit hole that runs a considerable distance if you know sort of how to follow it. So hopefully, again, this will be a good illustration of that. And we encourage you, this is what we try to do in the podcast. We try to get you into this content and then tell you where you can get more.
All right, Mike. Well, that pretty much takes us to the Exodus. So I assume we're going to touch on 12 again, Exodus, moving into the parting of the Red Sea.
Yeah, we're getting really close.
So I'm going to have to watch
some. I don't know if we can. Yeah, there you go. What an excuse. Yeah.
Back to the action.
You know, I'm going to have to put some more thought into it because, you know, when you get to the Exodus, you have obviously Exodus 13 and 14. Of course, Exodus 15 is the Song of Moses. About the Exodus, but you have issues of chronology. Again, you know, we're going to have to get back into that. You know, we may have to divide it up into a couple episodes again, but I'll give it some thought. But yeah, next week we'll get into it somehow. But I don't know how it'll break down.
All right, looking forward to it. All right, Mike. Well, I just want to remind everybody, please go leave us a review and rate us on iTunes or wherever you consume our podcast, help others find us. And we hope you're enjoying the Exodus. I promise you we're going to do a Q&A here sooner rather than later. And with that, Mike, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.